This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Carla F.C. Holloway was raised in a family of fighters. Her parents were school administrators working in New York State during busing and desegregation. Carla learned how to fight and what was worth fighting for. In college, she joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and marched in the streets of Birmingham, Alabama. As a longtime Duke professor, she melded academics with activism. She centered the voices of African-American women writers in her work, and she also helped shape the African and African-American Studies program at Duke. Carla Holloway is James B. Duke Professor Emerita of English at Duke University, just released her debut novel, A Death in Harlem, and we will talk with her all about that today when we meet Carla Holloway. Welcome back to the State of Things, Carla.
Good to have you here. It's really good to be here. Thank you for having me, Frank.
You grew up in Buffalo, New York.
We did.
At about the same time. But talk about growing up there, where you grew up, and what it was like for you.
Well, I remember a lot about the family dynamics of growing up. I was a fairly insular child, and maybe people don't believe it now. I'm still an insular adult, but I got pulled into a public role despite my own inclinations, and that was because of what was going on in Buffalo. That was my parents' situation in terms of being first Blacks, first Black director of, well, actually, I think we were Negro then, first Negro director of language arts for the public school system with my mother. And my father was the deputy superintendent of schools, would have been superintendent if not for the politics at the Board of Education. So, but he was still on the front lines of what was happening in the schools in terms of segregation and desegregation. And our dinner table was about how that politic was to be presented in our daily lives when we interacted in school. We were always the clap girls. There were three of us. I'm the middle daughter. And our public presentation was important to what they were doing and representing in the schools, a fact that we rarely understood with the same seriousness that they wanted us to. But we got the sense that it was important for us to conduct ourselves in what they considered an appropriate way.
I can't imagine what that would be like to be Black deputy superintendent in the 1970s, late 60s and early 70s, while desegregation is going on. It is perhaps uglier in the North than it even was in the South. I don't know that comparing these is even valuable, so I take it back. But it was a polarizing, difficult political debate. And what were the conversations? What was your father saying at the time?
Well, one of the issues was, what community was he representing? Because, you know, there was a Black community that was becoming more and more activist. You know, while he was going through this in Buffalo, I was at Talladega College deciding whether I was going the route of Martin Luther King or the route of Stokely Carmichael, who was frankly a lot cuter than Martin Luther King, you know, which is where my values were at the time. But that debate we were having at Talladega about accommodationist or integrationist rather than being an activist and being a non-accommodationist were the same issues that he was negotiating within the Black community at the same time he was sitting at the board table representing every point of view and having a perspective of his own that he wanted to make sure happened in Buffalo in terms of school children and desegregation.
Your family has deep roots in the state of New York. Tell us about your grandmother and her land ownership around the Palmer Memorial Institute.
Well,
right?
That's actually here in North Carolina. Right. When I moved to North Carolina, there was a branch of the family, the Tottens, who were not quite as closely affiliated with the Clapp side of the family, but we were all cousins and kin. And I didn't know that the breach had come because of a land dispute around Palmer Memorial Institute. My grandmother held some land that Charlotte Hawkins Brown wanted. And when Charlotte Hawkins Brown wanted some, she could write a vicious letter. So she wrote to my grandmother saying what my grandfather, who died when my father was nine, would have wanted. So playing the guilt card really hard. But my grandmother did not sell the land at the time. And that created a breach in the family that I didn't understand until I moved down here to North Carolina and realized my relatives were 90 minutes down the road. We've all reconciled, and Palmer is now a family institution. And my great-grandfather actually was a graduate of Palmer.
Wow. So there you have it, the two families, the North Carolina family, the New York State and Buffalo, New York. And then you talked about the powerful letters that went back and forth. Your mother was a letter writer.
Yes. And I apologize to anyone who may have received a letter from my mother. Mm-hmm. They either received a very warm and loving letter or they received a corrective letter. Mm-hmm. Everyone from the minister to a public figure to publishing companies. When my mother was, before she became director of language arts, she taught in the Buffalo school system, the teacher of language arts, and it offended her that an excerpt from Tarzan, the ape man, was in her anthology. Yeah. So she wrote to Scott Forsman and told her she would never use their books again until they took it out. And I remember a really, let's just say, highly pitched argument around our table about the best way to approach this. My father had a quieter, more insider's motivation. My mother would just write a letter and wait for the thing to be done. Years later, not too many years later, Scott Forsman wrote her, asked her to be an editor for junior high textbooks. And that's how black writers became represented in high school anthologies, because she went through and selected poems by Gwendolyn Brooks and Nikki Giovanni and Langston Hughes. And before that time, black writers were just not represented, and Tarzan went the way of Tarzan, never to appear again.
It worked. But fascinating that this was, the debate around your table, how far to go, and that a letter was considered kind of a radical act at this point.
Well, because she would sign it, and my father was extremely cautious about our public presentation. And I think that's what I remember most. Both parents were. My mother was willing to take risks with herself, but certainly not with her three daughters. You know, we were supposed to polish our sneakers and get on with the business of school. But at the same time, I remember being in school and telling people, well, when my father was the first black Negro principal of a school in South Buffalo, which, you know, is a Polish area of Buffalo. And the gym teacher said, your father's not a principal. I said, well, yes, he is. You know, and my sisters and I would get pushback from teachers as well as students about my parents' position. So we were negotiating that, you know, how to be cool. I just never made the cool.
I mean, highly segregated city, as you say. The South Buffalo is the province of the sort of Irish American. East Buffalo, the Polish American, and the West Side was Italian, fiercely so. And remnants of that remain today, although much of it has changed. But also deeply segregated. And I wonder what kind of conversations there were around the table, and whether or not you encountered that. Certainly in housing and other areas of life, you had to face that every single day.
Absolutely. And let me say, they were conversations between my parents, but not us. We were listeners. They never brought us in and said, girls, this is how you should conduct yourself because of what's going on. We were just auditors in these fierce battles. But I do remember when we moved to the area around Canisius College, and my mother wanted to live in closer to Delaware Park. And there was a beautiful area of town. I remember her on the phone using what I called her church voice, saying, well, I should let you know we are a Negro family. And I remember looking up at from the table and saying, who is she talking to and why? But the conversation ended there. We never saw that house on Agassiz Circle, which you might remember. Yeah. But the house was for sale, but it was not. There was a covenant, and we couldn't live in it. And my mother was aware enough of it to warn the realtor. So there were things. Mm. That's how I came by my racial knowledge, being a close listener, a good reader, but understanding that the battles fought, and I have to say they were battles, because they were both fierce advocates for how to do things, mm-hmm. and they were both correct all the time.
Well, and when you have to, again, when you think about the politics they're up against, being circumspect is a very wise choice, mm-hmm. How to do things, you know, just sort of fly at this and expect to succeed. You personally, as you said, you were more quiet behind the scenes. You were kept in many ways behind the scenes. Your right. parents, it seems to me, wanted to some degree, it feels like, protect you from the worst of it. And you were intrigued by the supernatural.
Always. And I don't remember when this started, but I thought a Ouija board was invented for me. I thought Eric Daniken's Chariots of the God just satisfied everything I ever wanted to think about as a possibility, and that sci-fi was literature. The first course I taught on my own at Duke, when they told me, teach what you want, I taught a sci-fi course. It was years ago, and I don't think I repeated it, but science fiction has always been my retreat because I like to think of things that we haven't thought about yet. The real was much too pedantic for me, and the imaginative, I think, was my escape. Yeah, I escaped in the Buffalo Public Library. I escaped with books in a closet. I see where my daughter got her habits of reading.
Well, eventually you got out, and we'll talk more about that and how that career outside the library and your closet led you finally to Duke University. Carla Holloway, James B. Duke, Professor Emerita of English at Duke, and we'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Carla Holloway today, who's made a career of integrating activism and academia. As a longtime Duke professor, she fought to strengthen the role of the school's African and African American Studies program and helped it become the fully fledged department it is today. She also worked to center the value of African American cultural practices, including funerals, while also highlighting the brilliance of African-American female writers. But before that, she went to an HBCU in Alabama, down from Buffalo, New York. You go to Talladega in Alabama. Talk about that decision.
Best decision I ever made. When it came down to it, it was going to be either Bennington College in Vermont or Talladega College in Alabama. I don't know how those two diametric choices came down to the end. But my father told me, my father and mother had both gone to Talladega. My father was drafted into the Army during his years there. So he actually finished at the University of Buffalo, but my mother finished at Talladega. He said, for 4 years in your life, you won't have to think about whether something's happening to you because of race. And now that I think about that, I think about all of the things that he was going through in Buffalo, and he wanted a sanctuary for me. I think people don't understand that HBCUs are sanctuaries in those ways. Our giftedness and our talents are taken for granted. You're just there to polish and shine them. Our abilities are never doubted because of race. And so it was a sanctuary in that sense. Of course, I brought my own brand of activism. I think my first month I led a protest against the Navy recruiting on campus because Vietnam was going on. So I think that was kind of new. I think I had the first Afro at Talladega.
Well, talk about that, because there was, I mean, integration was not necessarily something that HBCUs wanted to see, right? I mean, you had reason to protest on those campuses in those years.
Oh, absolutely. Our protests were about, you know, what kind of Black person we would be. Because, I mean, during my first year, Martin Luther King died, was shot. And I remember us gathering and the shock on campus when that happened. And Stokely Carmichael, also later to be known as Kwame Ture, but we knew him back in the day, came and told us how beautiful Black women were when they wore gold. Well, that sounded, you know, African gold too. It sounded right to me. Get your passport and go. But we were choosing between a certain kind of activism. So there was, and HBCUs represented a particular kind of traditionalism, both in education and in conduct. I mean, I was, you know, watched as to whether or not I wore gloves to town when I first came. I mean, you know, the gloves that you button at the edge mm-hmm. of your wrist, mm-hmm. Or a sweater. And the men were not allowed to cross the street after 5 p.m. to where the women's dorms were. Some did manage to cross the street. And I was involved with, or became involved with, a young man who was the director of research for SNCC. And that's how the Birmingham travel's happening. Not protesting in Birmingham, but really setting up the research agenda for SNCC. My first protest was actually the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, which was another collision for me, because I can remember telling my father, I left for the Poor People's Campaign from Buffalo. He was driving his Lincoln Continental down to the Fruit Belt Neighborhood Center where we were to leave from. And I asked him to drop me off several blocks ahead because I didn't want to go to the Poor People's Campaign from a Lincoln Continental. So I was just always negotiating which kind of black person I was going to be. And I think in one way that's followed me.
Well, that was, I mean, that was that transition period. Black nationalism is on the rise. And there was a lot of flux, of course, in that moment. What did your father think of this? You're now a member of SNCC, right? You're going to go to Birmingham. Now you're going to go to the Poor People's Campaign.
Well, when the young man that I married, have been married to for 47 years, who was the head of the student government, led the protests that shut down the college. Gosh, I'm trying to remember what we were protesting. I'm sure we had a list of demands. And we took over the administration building, and I sat in the dean's office and used the electric typewriter. Who knew that one day I would be a dean? But we shut the doors of the campus. And they sent telegrams to all of our parents saying, you know, your children are coming home. My father told me, don't come home. I didn't send you to Talladega to close down the campus, find something to do, because it won't be coming back to Buffalo. And suddenly I understood that there were consequences. And to think about, you know, maybe not at that moment, I was just trying to figure out which roommate I could tag along with to go home. But I did, I think he was asking me to think about the consequences. And I don't think he was at all pleased that I was involved with SNCC, involved with the more activist black nationalist side. But that was a side I chose at that point. And disappointing my father in that way mattered to me.
What was the next step? I mean, I'd like to hear more about that. If he says, don't come home, how do you take that? Do you feel like you're being cut off? Or in that moment, are you saying he's asking you to, sending you to time out?
No, it was more like a time out. Yeah. It was more like, you know, if you have the ability to take actions, but you also have the responsibility of accepting the consequences, I'm not going to be here for consequences that I don't agree with. And that was a father I understood perfectly. Matter of fact, I'm wondering now why I ever asked for the bus ticket or the plane ticket back home. I should have known what he would say. And I was also very aware of putting them in a difficult situation, because in Buffalo, I grew up answering reporters on the phone, Mr. Clapp has no comment. That's what I remember, you know, picking up the telephone and saying no comment to reporters who would call about the critical education issues around busing and desegregation. So this representing the race that I did, as far as my father was concerned, a misstep in Buffalo. He couldn't have me home. Yeah. Somebody would call me and ask me, what did you do down there at Talladega? Yeah. So I think it was safer for him and for me to keep me
in your mind
south.
Did you begin to question his whole, the tactics? Because that's part of what was happening with families. As younger people were coming of age, they may have respected what their parents were doing, but you become angry. And what did you sort of say? Second thoughts about your father's tactics?
No, not in that way, because I always had, now there were three of us girls, so we each had a different role to play in the family, and I was really more of an accommodationist. So I really tried to understand, and I think that helped me, being the person. So what was it that made him say no to his middle daughter, whom he loves so much? So I was much more interested in the analysis that led him to what I knew was a difficult decision for him than I was in the punishment per se. And it was more like, so what? My daughter's always telling me, you're always imagining what meeting happened before you got in the room. So I'm trying to think, so what was the conversation mom and dad had before dad called? And he was a man of very few words. Mm-hmm. My mother was the was the talker. My father was quiet. If he had something to say, the two calls I remember are "No, you can't come home," and the call about him not being appointed to the superintendent's position. And he started that call with, "Now you will see how your father handles failure." And I was shocked out of my skin that he would think that this was failure and that he would be feeling badly and that he would let me know about it. So there were so many levels of that. So it was much more interesting for me to analyze that. And I think that's what I carried from those moments.
Coming out of Alabama and Talladega, you were thinking you might want to be a school teacher. Is that right?
I did. Matter of fact, I taught for at least half a year in the Buffalo Public Schools, seventh grade language arts. And I'm convinced still today that a 21-year-old college graduate has no room in a middle school classroom. Just wait until you've at least hit 40. Yeah. And there was something about the regimentation and the routine that was just not me. And I had already applied to go into graduate school. But by that time, I understood that my graduate education was going to be about literature and not about education. So I moved from what might have been an education graduate degree to one in literary criticism, American lit, linguistics. So
you went to Michigan State.
I went to Michigan State. I chose Michigan State because I was following a famous linguist that I knew had been teaching there. I didn't know he only taught there in the summers.
Well, that's the only time to be in Michigan, really.
That's a good point. So when I got there, there was no sociolinguist there for me to study with. So I ended up taking psycholinguistics and cognitive and mixing it with American literature and sort of discovering Zora Neale Hurston had done the same kind of mixed up, you know, combined degree. And sort
well,
of
then you need to tell us the story. Forgive me for interrupting, but this, how you met Zora Neale Hurston, because that's a story.
I met Zora Neale in a graduate classroom, which I had no business in because I was a graduate student, but the TA in that classroom was even cuter than Stokely Carmichael was. So I just thought I would sit in his classroom. I didn't expect to really learn anything there, but he mentioned Zora Neale Hurston one day and that she was a linguist and wrote novels. And that interest lasted much longer than my interest in the TA. But that was a fortuitous meeting of the minds.
And your interest in Zora Neale Hurston in her work in particular, but also Black female writers.
Right. Zora Neale introduced me to that there were Black writers who would not be well known. As I mentioned, the TA just mentioned her in passing. She wasn't known in the literary canon. This was before Alice Walker discovered her grave in Eatonville, Florida. But what appealed to me was that she was a linguist. She had studied with Franz Boas at Columbia, and she was a novelist. She had written Their Eyes Were Watching God, which hadn't yet become the phenom publishing novel that it is today in women's studies curricula. So when I studied Hurston, I think I was trying to study a way to be in the academic world myself. So it was a model of a certain kind of interdisciplinarity that I think has always has since that point characterized my career.
Did you have any aspirations to write yourself?
I don't think so. I think I knew that if I was going to go into college teaching that I would write as an academic. But writing what I've done now as a fiction writer, who knew? I think I had to just reach that 70th birthday and say, okay, what's next, Carla Holloway? I knew I did not want to be the same kind of person I had been as an academic. I knew when I wrote my last academic book, Legal Fictions, that it was the last book. Mm. As a matter of fact, I think I wrote something in the dedication about, thanks everybody for coming, see you. You know, really, really kind of flippant, but the novel, A Death in Harlem, is a marvel to me.
Well, and it also points back to, at one time, a very little known, somewhat better known writer now, Nella Larsen.
Right.
Well, tell us
a
little bit about this novel, A Death in Harlem, and its relationship to other, to at least Nella.
I had been teaching Nella Larsen ever since I've been teaching Black women writers. And her most famous novella, Passing, ends with a policeman walking by a death scene saying, "Death by misadventure." Well, misadventure all by itself is a word that just, you know, stopped me in my tracks. And this was a story about two women who were light enough to pass, and one of them goes out a window of a Harlem party. It appealed to me because I understood the sedity background of these women, the social class, because this was the class that I navigated in Buffalo. These were the Black Greek letter organizations and the sororities and the fraternities and their offshoots and the Jack and Jills and the debutante balls. So I knew there was an era of Harlem. I'm calling it now Downton Abbey meets Harlem because I was always fascinated by the clothing, the excess, the way in which that Black upper class crust life was supported by regular Black folks in Harlem, too. So I wanted to bring them together in a novel. Started it thinking that I would just answer the question Nella Larsen left in Passing. How did she fall out the window? And suddenly the characters took voices and characterizations of their own. And I worked on this novel about 7 or 8 years until it became A Death in Harlem. And I'm just thrilled.
I'm going to talk a little bit more. I want to dip back just for a moment and tell us a little more about Nella Larsen and who she was.
Nella Larsen was a writer during the Harlem Renaissance, that storied era of Harlem, where writers and artists came together in Harlem to find Congress and camaraderie that they did not, they also found in Chicago, but it was a moment of time in Harlem where the arts were celebrated. Now, as Langston Hughes said, the ordinary Negro did not know anything was going on in terms of a renaissance of works. But there was certainly a class of artists, both visual and written and musicians, who gathered in Harlem to congregate amongst themselves. And Nella Larsen was one of those. She came to Harlem to write. She had a really interesting connection to Denmark. And what her second novel explores that connection of being light enough to pass, what that meant in Black life. And to me, that's like a mystery and sci-fi both. You know, what does it mean to be light enough to pass? What does it mean for identity to be already known by appearance, and yet there's something hidden beneath, maybe in the blood? So the imaginative part of me wanted to take that story from Nella Larsen's ending and see what would happen if I figured out what did happen to the woman who fell out of the window, who came out of the window. Was she killed? Did she? She had plenty of reasons to be killed, plenty of reasons to jump, and plenty of reasons to, you know, be accidentally pushed. So because of my law school background, there had to be a trial. Yeah. So I wrote a novel with at least a grand jury investigation in it. I wrote about the life that Larsen opened to me in terms of exploring the lives of the rich and famous in Harlem and what the underbelly of their lives were like. And then the folk who enabled those lives, the Black people who worked for them as maids and drivers and funeral home caretakers. So,
was it difficult for you? Did you have to give yourself permission as a scholar, as a you know, someone who had studied law? Right, you've got your JD, you've got a PhD in English. Your whole life has been writing these academic tracks, and now you get to free yourself. And
it was a master's of law. I didn't get the JD because I had a job.
All right, pretty far along the way. But so was it hard for you to write fiction?
It was almost. Well, the writing was very difficult, but the move to fiction was an ease and a freedom and a sanctuary, which I will embrace until my dying day. There is not another academic book in me, but there may well be another fiction because I said it. I was at the Regulator Books the other night, and I realized, oh, academic freedom. This must be what it is. Finally, as an emerita, I discover it. So I have to be responsible to when were gaslights invented. And the first colored policeman, who is the man in my book who investigates this mysterious death in Harlem. Well, he actually appears in the Harlem scene in 1908. I have him closer to the Renaissance era, 1918, 1920. So I did take some license there.
But he might have still been on the job. He was hired in 08, yeah. But he was still working.
Giving myself license was like a gift.
Wow. Great stuff. Well, we're going to continue this conversation with Carla Holloway, James B. Duke Professor Emerita of English at Duke. Talk more about that and her career at Duke University when our conversation continues after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Carla Holloway today, James B. Duke Professor Emerita of English at Duke University. We talked about the book that you wrote more or less when that career had ended. How did it start? How did you get started at Duke?
I came to Duke in 1993 as a visiting professor. Duke thought it had made a fabulous hire of the famous Henry Louis Gates, whom they did hire for a hot minute until Harvard's position came open and Skip Gates skipped out of Duke and went to Harvard. And suddenly he had recruited students to come to work with him. So I remember Stanley Fish calling me one night and saying, come over and teach this course. I came to Duke at the back door of the Allen Building to teach a night course, and I never left. I left eventually as retired. But I do think it was interesting coming in the back door at night. So I sort of slipped into Duke, and it wasn't until the University of Pennsylvania tried to recruit me that Duke became more interested in keeping me, because I do think, at least at that time and likely now, the name of your degree, I'm public education and HBCU, where it came from mattered, and Penn sort of validated me. I think it was interesting that Penn sent me the letter of offer by the department fax machine, so everybody in the English department knew it. So I don't know if I would have gone to Penn, but that's when they made me an offer to stay. And I found myself in a negotiation with Duke and thought that I could have a place there.
What was that place? How did you imagine your role at that time?
I didn't imagine it like to be there, Skip Gates. I imagined I would teach in the English department and that would be it. But I constantly, and you know, quietly in the English department, teaching my sci-fi course. But I constantly was called. It was the same year that they got their first woman president, and there were student protests. And I remember the president, the student, black student protests. And when they took over the Allen Building, the president said, "Call Carla." Carla does not know these students.
I've never been on the front door. I don't even know where the front door is.
Go.
Is there parking?
No, there wasn't parking. But I did find the lobby and the president's office. Yeah. And I found myself in an advisory role where I think I was helpful, because I did understand administrative nonsense, you know, the kind of protocols, what she was facing. I also knew what she was facing as a first woman president.
This is Nan Cohan.
This is Nan Cohan. Yeah. We became very close and still have a shared fondness. But as I was not the first black professor in the English department, I was the first liberal black professor in the English department. And then suddenly I was asked to chair. Nan brought in a very progressive provost who asked me to chair the university's promotion and tenure committee. This is the one who set protocol for the entire institution except for the law school. Tenure for the med school came through my committee. Tenure for every department in arts and sciences came through this committee. And sitting at the head of that board table in the Allen boardroom, knowing that the faculty could change under my watch only if I were careful about it and attentive in ways more like my father than my mother. And I called my father a lot during those days. And then he asked me to chair the AFAM studies program. And I was smart enough, because I think it was a smart decision, to say I would only do it if I continued to chair the tenure committee, because I knew that was where the power lay at Duke. So doing both at the same time allowed me to help the program make an argument that would wash in the committees that it had to go through. But I think I also earned some respect from colleagues. I remember a very conservative colleague in academic council wrote me ahead of time and said, here are the arguments I'm going to bring against your becoming a fully fledged program that could tenure. I'm just doing this because I like you. we didn't agree on a darned thing, but he respected me and I respected him, and I could make the arguments because he had given me, let me in on the meeting before the meeting.
You always wondered. Well, talk about that, because you did have a role in shaping and helping African and African-American studies go from a program to a full tenure department.
And my first battle, frankly, was with students who didn't understand the difference between a cultural center and an academic program. And also then with Duke, who wanted to fund everything Black the same way. And I said, no, the cultural center is a cultural center. It's a meeting place for students. It's where we have, you know, cultural events that are rooted in the Black cultural experience. An academic program, courses, intellectual pursuits, tenured professors who do work in deeply rooted political science exercises, and they cannot be the same thing. And you have to understand that Black stuff is complicated. You have to be able to support it in both financial ways, and I have to be able to help students understand that these are separate entities. So, I'm just thinking I was, you know, working with a Black community that didn't quite agree with my point of view. I think the professors in the department certainly understood it. But this was during the time of unrest and upheaval among Black students.
What was the argument against it? That somehow this was taking away from the cultural
program? Yes, exactly that. That there were a few dollars to go around. Yeah. And I had always followed the money at Duke. My father was, before he became deputy superintendent, was director of finance and research. And he told me, if you don't know the budget, then you don't know your job. Mm-hmm. So me, who is numerically averse, had to learn budgets and spreadsheets and understand, you're just going to have to fund both of these things. So it was during that time that we funded the Mary Lou Williams Cultural Center, moving from a basement. You don't put a cultural center in a basement, Duke, to having its own brick-and-mortar facility that would honor both the name of Mary Lou Williams and honor the cultural interests of the students. So let's move it out of this basement or attic spaces. Duke had basements and attics for Black stuff, and give them funding and also fund positions in Black studies.
So you may have been channeling your father in the careful negotiation and navigating the Byzantine world of academia. But at one point at Duke, you channeled your mother and wrote a letter. Now I'm talking about the group of 88 and the Duke lacrosse story that broke and, of course, had this whole area and region and nation in thrall for a while. Talk about that, because it was perceived that letter that you and 87 other people signed was an indictment, a rush to judgment about a group of students who ultimately turned out to be not guilty.
Nonsense in terms of a rush to judgment or an indictment. As a matter of fact, have people who go back and read the actual letter and say, it doesn't say that at all, does it? What I learned from that moment was that your words can be taken and used, especially, thank God there was not Twitter or Facebook when this happened, but there were blogs, and they were the bane of my existence, because they'd take a passage or a phrase, twist it into something that had not been said or intended. And I was very unhappy with my words being used in ways I had not intended.
What was the intention of that letter? The word lacrosse doesn't occur, and we're now talking, none of the names were used. You weren't really referring directly, although there were definitely, the timing was, it was certainly related to the conversations that were happening around this Duke lacrosse story.
It was a letter, it was actually a series of quotes from students who had been in a meeting that was designed to be a seminar. And we realized the students in the room were so upset that they needed a chance to just vent and talk. And one of the professors was writing down things that the students were saying. And this was about their being harassed and bullied on campus because they were Black. This was a mostly Black audience, although not totally. There were women who were talked about, you know, sexual harassment on campus that sort of bubbled to a dangerous boil at that point. Students being harassed on the bus and accused of being the accusers of these boys. So students, like they always are, were totally inner folks and saying, I'm feeling attacked. And we let the students speak and we captured with their permission the students' words. And if you go back and read it, there is one quote that says, we're not even talking about the girls who made the accusation. And that was the only thing in it, because nobody knew at that time. It was too new in the moment what had happened, but students were intensely focused on how they felt. And as a student advocate, my sense was that students had a right to be heard and that Duke was not listening. So I think the ad, we might have titled it, "We Are Listening to Our Students." So this group of faculty wanted to say, we are listening to how you are feeling. And I would sign the letter in a heartbeat again today, as I signed it then. And Duke has yet to learn quite how to process things around race, difference, gender, even sexuality. It's, I think, not well advised. My own protest at that time, eventually I took myself off of all of the committees I was put on after that, because the president violated a rule of protocol for me. The precedent was that students who were under indictment were expelled from campus. He and the vice president at the time, decided that the evidence did not merit the indictment and decided to admit the students back to campus. I thought that was terrible protocol. Whether his judgment was going to be correct in the end or not, what were we going to do when the next student came along? That's where my proceduralist tendencies come from my father. The procedure was, this is what happens when. And when you go outside of the procedures, you're changing the rules. And don't change the rules on me, because I know the rules. You know, I'm not the Roberts Rules of Order person, but I will know how things are done in an orderly fashion, so I can call on you the next time and say, the last time you did it this way, why are you changing it? Bad move on Duke's part.
Do you think, you said you'll sign it again. I was going to ask you if you have any regrets.
My regret is the way that it became not just about me, but my family, and the way that a public media now pulls every part of your life and your family's life into a prominence that I would not have wanted for them. I don't know what I could have done to change that. I think I would have made the decision thinking, okay, and in 8 months, somebody's going to report on your daughter's wedding, you know, and say, my gosh, what kind of man did she marry? I can't tell his race, you know, in a blog, you know, so as if this were relevant to anything. So it's a bit of privacy that I lost that I thought I had more control of. I regret that.
One of the areas of Black life that you focus on in Black cultural life is of funeral practices. Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in that? And how do you, and what do you think about?
Frank, by the time we finish talking, I'm going to know why I'm my father's daughter. But my father was a mortician for a brief period of time while he was recovering from tuberculosis. He was sent to a tuberculosis recovery home and then had to make up the school year in Louisville, where we had he had an uncle who owned a mortuary. As a matter of fact, lived above the mortuary. As a child, when we went to Louisville, we stayed above the mortuary and, of course, at night went down and played amongst the caskets. My sister was much better at scaring me than I was. But so my father was trained as a mortician. My mother said at the time they were married that you can touch them or me, meaning the embalmed folk. So that's why he went on to get his higher ed degree. But I think this was my way of entering that storied era of Black death and dying. You know, there's even a funeral scene in my novel. I think that you can't, Black death and dying surrounds us. I was coming at it in a very academic fashion. I was actually writing a chapter on the death of children, mostly during the 1920s through 50s, when my own son was killed. And that's the one time in my life when I lost the ability to both read and write. And my academic life came crashing into my personal.
Hello, I haven't left you enough time, but I do want to talk about the passing of your son, your adopted son, Bem. Maybe you can tell us a little more about that.
Bem's horrific crimes stunned our family into a grief that I think we and the community he harmed will never recover from. And we carry that grief with us in different ways every day. He harmed in ways that I can't begin to express, grievous ways, more families, including his own. I had to learn to live with that grief. I had to learn to live with a certain kind of loss. He was shot trying to escape from prison. I do think that he would have been someone who committed more crimes if he had not been killed. But that doesn't mean I didn't lose my son, whom I loved. I don't know how my life, what it would have been like without him, and I don't want to know. I do know that the moments he had of love and happiness came from being in our family. He was adopted right after a tornado destroyed our home in Kalamazoo. And we all started new as a family. But I think there were harms that happened to him. He was in several foster homes, four or five, by the time he was four or five, that could not be undone. But it taught me something about myself I thought I'd never have to learn, and that is I could love hard. The most difficult person in the world to love was him, and I still do. The easiest person, my husband, my daughter, I mean, they're like gifts. But to learn that I could love through that was something I think I might not have learned about myself. To be a parent who has lost a child is an exquisite company. I wish I weren't in it.
Carla Holloway, James B. Duke Professor Emerita of English at Duke University and the author of the novel A Death in Harlem. Carla, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Frank.
Carla Holloway is going to talk about the novel today at 6 at a ticketed event in Charlotte for the Women's National Book Association. And we have information at our website, stateofthings.org. That's the State of Things for today. State of Things produced by North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.